KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Microsoft is sailing on pretty stormy seas right now. The company took a $900 million hit reported last week. We're going to hear more later this hour from GeekWire's Todd Bishop. A Canadian health policy researcher has uncovered details of ongoing experimentation carried out on unknowing Aboriginal children and adults. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer is here with details on that story and more. Good morning, Vaughn.
Good morning, Marcy.
So tell me a little bit about these experiments.
Ian Mosby is a medical doctor, and he's published his research on this. He says it's the most disturbing thing he's ever done. It's the hardest thing he's ever had to write. Essentially, he was doing research on healthcare in Canada, and he came across in the archives references to nutritional experiments on Native Indians, mostly children, during World War II. What he found was that government officials had discovered that Native people were in pretty dire straits during the war in remote northern communities. And they found they were suffering from malnutrition, they were listless, they had no jobs, they were depressed, all understandable. Instead of simply arranging an airlift and feeding them, the government officials decided this would be a good time to see whether you could connect levels of nutrition to mental outlook and depression. So what they did was they created two test groups. They gave some of those people vitamins, and they didn't give some of the others vitamins, and then they studied the results. So they treated them like guinea pigs. They treated them like a lab experiment. We know that some of this pretty awful stuff has happened in the past. These are revelations, however, to Canadians, shocking, depressing, upsetting, that it was going on here, and that really they were so cavalier with the lives of Native people.
Vaughn, I just have to, it's a horrible story, and I hate to interrupt you, but I have to ask, are you on a speakerphone? Because we're getting some weird feedback.
No, I'm not, although I'm hearing an echo of my own voice, and I know journalists love to hear the sound of their own voice, but in this case, it is slightly annoying.
So what we're going to do is ask you to hold your thought, and we're going to dial you back up on a regular phone, and we're going to continue this conversation, okay?
Okay, great.
That's Vaughn Palmer. He is talking to us from Victoria, British Columbia, and we'll be back with our conversation just a minute here on Weekday.
Quick weather update. In the meantime, it's 70 degrees currently in Seattle, mostly sunny. Forecast calls for sun all day with an afternoon high of 84.
And this is Weekday. Vaughn Palmer back with us via regular telephone. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Marcy.
Oh, that's much better. No echo. So yeah, we can each hear each other. So this experimentation with the vitamins, how many kids or adults are we talking about that were involved?
The researcher who did this work, Ian Mosby, says about 1,300 people, mostly children. He says that the experiments were conducted, as I said, it started in 1942. The fallout from this, I guess you'd say, the reaction has been horror, but we've also had a lot of leaders of Canada's Native community demanding that, you know, more detail, for one thing, that government put it all out there. In this case, you have a medical researcher who simply uncovered this through scientific detection work through the archives. This has never not been known. It was sitting there in the files that it happened, but not been known that it happened. And the other thing is the Native community, Native leaders have been calling on the government to admit what happened here, to apologize, obviously, and to give us a full report on whether there were any consequences, because it's not entirely clear yet. Some of these people may still be alive. Some of them may have been affected right through their lives by the fact that their own government was experimenting on them.
What was the government's reaction, or what has the government's reaction been?
The first reaction from the government has been, and again, this story is still developing, but the first reaction from the government has been that the government of Canada has already apologized extensively to Native communities for the way they were treated in Canada over the years. Their children were taken away from them. They were put into government and church-run homes. There was terrible physical, mental, and sexual abuse in those homes. There is a National Truth and Reconciliation Commission that is looking into this, and there has already been considerable amounts of compensation paid for the abuse. So the government has said, look, we're already dealing with an awful lot of this. They're not denying it happened. They're simply saying that we're already on the road on this one. I would guess, however, that what you're going to see is that this will be incorporated into the work of that commission. The researcher, as I said, has just started publishing his work on it from government documents. So it appears, in fact, I'm just looking at the latest story on this, and in addition to the initial case on the northern prairie provinces of Canada, later experiments were conducted, or at least plans were developed to conduct further experiments here in British Columbia, in Ontario, Nova Scotia, and in Alberta. So the government says it's shocked by this. I think you're probably going to hear more about it when more detail comes out.
Well, we'll talk with you about it as this unfolds. Another piece of bad news, or more than a piece of bad news for Prime Minister Harper's government. He's taking flak again. This time, the government has put out a memo asking new cabinet ministers for their enemy lists.
Just in time for Watergate summer.
Yeah.
The 40th anniversary, 40 years ago today, I was in front of a television set watching every minute of the Senate Watergate hearings and reveling in every aspect of bad behavior by the Nixon administration, including the famous enemies list. Well, in the middle of a cabinet shuffle recently, the media, the Globe and Mail newspaper, got a hold of a memo that was generated in the Prime Minister's office. So this memo was intended to go into the briefing books for the new cabinet ministers, the transition binders. So you've got one minister coming in, another one going out. And one of the things it was to make up a list of who to engage for the minister and who to avoid. Friends and enemy stakeholders, friendly stakeholders, enemy stakeholders. And it suggested putting together a list of this for the minister, so that the minister could, you know, not have meetings with people who were enemies, not answer questions from people who were enemies, and stick to try to dealing with friends.
I just have to ask you a quick question. So that means that government officials are only expected to talk with people that agree with them?
Well, this one, you know, is bad on a whole number of levels for the government, and it's embarrassed them terribly. This cabinet shuffle was designed to put a new face on the government that was in some considerable political trouble and that was seen as kind of authoritarian and centralized and mean and nasty. And needless to say, this memo didn't dispel those notions. There's been some fun, of course, made of this, too, as various critics of the government and interest groups have stepped forward claiming status as enemies or saying, you know, we're just making the case. We thought the government was supposed to govern for everybody, not just for the people who agrees with it. The government has disavowed the memo. There have been denials that the actual enemies lists were put together, but it provided a window on thought processes in the office of Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and it confirmed the worst suspicions of a lot of the government's critics.
So how bad are things for Harper's government at this point?
Well, he's in the middle of a term, so you've got to always keep that in mind, that governments that are in midterm, he didn't have to call an election for a couple more years yet, so governments that are in midterm are often unpopular, and his certainly is. Some of that is of his own making. I think Harper's heavy hand, centralized control, what is seen as meanness has been on display too much. And there's an effort within the government to start changing that image. A lot of his older ministers left the government in the recent shuffle. He brought in a lot of new faces, including 8 women ministers. So they're trying. But this was a bad launch because of the enemies list. I think people are going to remember that. Just, you know, it's not like the enemies list that Richard Nixon had, where we actually had names and people were on the list. What we know here is that some thought was given to preparing one. We don't know if there is actually an enemies list, although a lot of people have their suspicions.
Well, I was just going to ask if you were on it. So you can't answer that question, can you?
No, I think there'd be hundreds of people on the list ahead of me. I rarely, other than on this show, do an awful lot of national coverage, and I'm not based in Ottawa. I would think the Prime Minister's enemies list, if it were only confined to the people in Ottawa, would probably fill a couple of telephone directories.
Well, while we're on some national news, before we move back to the Northwest, I understand transportation safety officials are telling the Canadian government that it needs to tighten up rail safety regulations in the wake of the horrible explosion in Quebec.
Yeah, that terrible accident, the train that exploded in Quebec and killed, well, we still don't have a complete list of how many people it killed, but at least 50 people. The Canadian government has actually just yesterday announced tightening of regulation for the movement of hazardous goods in the country. So they've issued new guidelines for the railways relating to what happened here. So the first rule is that all trains loaded with hazardous goods must be run by at least two qualified people. So the railways have been reducing staffing on trains. They've been down to one person in some cases, including with this accident. The second thing is that trains with hazardous goods cannot be left unattended on the main track. Again, that's what happened here. The train was unattended in a town. Whatever happened with the brakes, it broke loose in the middle of the night and ran downhill unattended till it jumped the tracks in the middle of a town, exploded, and killed all these people. Another rule is that there must be a much better handling of handbrakes. So they're going to need better handbrake systems, and they're going to need to have something in place so that an unattended train can't move. All this in the wake of the accident. It is unusual for the Transportation Safety Board and for Transport Canada to do this before the inquiry is complete. There's been some suggestion that they're, you know, getting ahead of themselves on this, but I think they're responding to widespread public concern and to the initial findings of what went wrong in this accident.
Hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that quick action was taken. Jumping back to Vancouver Island, the issue of sewage treatment and what you guys do with your raw sewage has been an issue for decades, if not longer. And now I understand that a possible plant that was to be constructed outside of Victoria is being held up by the local town's board of directors. And I don't know how to pronounce, is it Esquimalt?
Squimalt.
Squimalt,
so,
see?
Yes. For most of the time I've been doing this show, which is going back to 1987 now, we've been talking about Victoria's good intentions on treating its sewage, which we're still not doing, but we are going to get around to doing it one of these days. And the current plan, which is well advanced, calls for the construction of a sewage treatment plant at the entrance to Victoria Harbor in the community of Esquimalt. We're down to bargaining with Esquimalt now. The regional government has decided that's where the sewage treatment plant goes, and Esquimalt is saying, what's in it for us? The regional government has offered them about $1 million worth of amenities. As essentially an incentive, or shall we call it a payment, for accepting the sewage treatment plant. And Esquimalt has come back and said that's not good enough. So the regional government was going to give them $1 million, upgrades to local electrical, firefighting services, a public walkway, road and bike lane improvements, and a sewage education center, about which perhaps... go ahead and make a joke.
Anyway,
Esquimalt says that's not good enough. They've come back and they want all construction materials for the sewage treatment plant to be barged in so it's not hauled through local streets. They want a public open space worth $75,000, a children's playground. Hey, kids, let's go play at the sewage treatment plant. Sorry. A public walkway, reclaimed water use, underground utilities, and this one does sound kind of critical, top-level odor reduction technology.
Mm-hmm.
and a payment of $55,000 a year going into the future for an amenity fund. So they're bargaining back and forth. I think they're hoping that the provincial government will eventually step in and maybe throw some dough into the pot as well. The provincial government is saying no, it's local government's job to sort this out. Regional government has the authority. The local government's going to have to take the treatment plan at some point, and the bargaining continues. But we're going to get around to it one of these days, I promise.
I'm glad to hear that it'll be. So at some point, you'll stop dumping sewage someplace. Just really briefly, Vaughn, you have a new little king to be.
Oh, yeah, and Canadians aren't paying any attention to this story at all, right? Okay, so Victoria, right? A little piece of old England. There's a baby book in the lobby of the Empress Hotel that people are signing. And I want you to know, the local interviews suggest that even American tourists are caught up in this, signing the baby book. The Monarchist League here in Victoria already had a garden party last week in anticipation of the baby's arrival, so there'll be another one. And I noticed this morning the Victoria Times columnist, our local newspaper, and a good paper it is, has a separate section on the royal birth. So, yeah, it's kind of the big story here in town. Pretty much everything else is sort of secondary at the moment.
And we now know his name. He is Prince George Alexander Lewis Windsor, I guess is his last name.
And I like to think, Marcy, that they chose the name George because King's name George has such wonderful resonation with our friends in the United States.
Oh, my. Okay, Vaughn, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Vaughn Palmer is a columnist for the Vancouver Sun, a regular Wednesday guest on Weekday, and oh, rule Britannia.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Film critic Robert Horton's with us once again, and we're thinking about bromance, but maybe not bromance, but film duos, of which there are oh so many. And we put this question to you. I think the first one I can think of is Bing Crosby and Bob Hope.
Yes, that's a good one. That's one of my favorites.
And they made like a zillion movies together?
They made a handful, yeah.
Is it only a handful?
Well, I think it was like seven or so, but that's a lot. That's a pretty good run. I suppose the ones who loom in the background of this would be Laurel and Hardy.
When are you going to pay me for your board and room?
I gave it to him.
What did you give it to him for?
Well, he said he was boss, not Noah.
Oh, he did, huh?
Don't get sore, honey. I was only kidding.
And from now on, you pay me for your board.
Well, we got to be running along. Come on, Stanley. Goodbye, honey.
Goodbye.
Where do you think you're going?
Well, we're going to the ball game.
You're going to the ball game?
Well, certainly. We businessmen have to relax sometime, don't we, Stanley?
We certainly do.
Well, if you want to relax, you can stay home and wash these dishes.
Do bromances have to be between funny men? I mean, there's not like a... Well, there are. I mean, maybe like sidekicks that are not so much based in gags or humor.
Right. And Paul Newman and Robert Redford. I suppose we don't think of them as funny. But certainly one of the...
Well, witty. Those movies are what, in the 70s?
Yeah.
Early 70s? I'm thinking of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Came out in 1969, yeah.
And they also did that great heist.
The Sting.
The Sting.
Yep, 73.
Was there a third movie?
No, they talked about doing another one, but those were huge, huge hits at the time.
Is it a matter of chemistry, good script, the fact that they might look well on screen together?
Yeah, it's funny, you know, because it has to be more than a good script, because we know that, like, even Hope and Crosby were improvising sometimes around their scripts. And there was a little bit of on-camera, you know, vamping going on. And sometimes the scripts weren't that good. Sometimes the
jokes... I was going to say, these are like the road to such and such
road
place.
Road to Morocco and road to Hong Kong and, yeah, they managed to get past it, even if the jokes kind of went flat, you know? And it is, I think it is that chemistry thing, and it's the how the way two people know each other and kind of know each other's rhythms and where to fit into that and have a certain attitude toward each other that is important, and that the audience can participate in. Like, we know if this one says something, we know how the other one is going to react, because that is such a well-defined characterization on both parts.
I'm thinking of a whole slew of people, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis.
Right.
That was sort of the suave straight man and the goofy goofball. Jerry Lewis's role was just to be a clown.
Yeah, and with those guys, it would go back to vaudeville, you know, where you'd have a straight man and then the funny guy, Abbott and Costello, being an example of people who literally did stretch all the way back to vaudeville. And, you know, one guy is really not that funny, in the case of Bud Abbott, but he sets up Lou Costello to do all of his wacky things, and then he reacts to it. When Laurel and Hardy were doing their thing, you know, you knew that Stan Laurel would find some way to mess something up, and it would become an elaborate thing, and then Oliver Hardy, who was more or less the straight man, yeah, but who was also quite a funny fellow, you know, you could anticipate that he would react in a particularly exasperated way, occasionally look at the camera as though to say, what am I going to do with this guy? How did I get here? What is the state of the world that has put me in as the companion to this crazy person?
Well, that gets me to thinking about, they didn't use the word bromance at that point, but particular pairing that for me worked really well was Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. in the Sherlock Holmes movies. And you could like or hate the movies, and they were totally ridiculous, but those two had great chemistry, and Jude Law was the straight man, as Watson is to Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, he sets up the genius in what he's doing.
See his walking stick, a rare African snake wood, hiding a blade, 5 tensile steel. A few were awarded to veterans of the Afghan War, so I can assume he's a decorated soldier, strong, brave, born to be a man of action.
And?
Neat, like all military men. Now, I check his pockets. Ah, a stump from a boxing match. Now, I can infer that he's a bit of a gambler. I'd keep an eye on that dowry if I were you.
Those days are behind me.
Right behind you. It's cost us the rent more than once.
Well, with all due respect, Mr. Holmes, you know John very well. What about a complete stranger? What can you tell about me?
You? I don't think that's... I don't know that that's...
Not a dinner.
Perhaps some other time.
I insist.
You insist?
You remember we discussed this.
The lady insists.
And in some ways, you could look back at the Sherlock Holmes and Watson stories as maybe an early example of predicting this kind of thing.
You mean the print stories you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Wow. The Conan Doyle stories, and just thinking... Well, there's an example, if we take Hope and Crosby or Laurel and Hardy as having distinct personalities, so do Holmes and Watson. You know, they couldn't be more different from each other, so they staked out different images and different personalities, and it's that we enjoy. That's what we enjoy, is that one of them is this, and the other one is maybe, if not the polar opposite, then at least carries these other kind of things, and that's where the chemistry comes from. That's where the interplay comes from. That sometimes it drives the plot, because Watson has to be saying, what did you mean by saying, how did you know that
right,
and so on.
Aside from that Downey and Law pairing, contemporary pairs that work particularly well, somebody mentioned to me Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson, who've been paired together in a bunch of comedies. I confess I haven't seen them, so I don't know whether those play into this same kind of on-screen duo or not.
Right. And there's, I mean, the fact that we can talk about something called a bromance suggests that this phenomenon is very much alive these days, and that this has been coined in recent years of very, very guy-oriented comedies. And it's funny, because they actually can pair off in different ways. Vince Vaughn a couple of times was associated with Jon Favreau, who's now a successful director, and they made a couple of films early on, and they clearly were friends. You could tell that they were probably friends off screen. Guys from that school of Seth Rogen and his Jonah Hill. Sometimes he and Jonah Hill have great chemistry. Seth Rogen, if you think of Pineapple Express, Rogen and James Franco as the ridiculously paired, kind of out of it stoner guys, had a hilarious rapport I think, at least in that film. And those that group keeps combining and recombining in all these different movies where some at some point all of them, are, I think, are going to do a buddy film, probably opposite each other.
Well, so you mentioned bromance. We don't call it cismance. But what about Amy Poehler and Tina Fey?
I think that is a good that's a good suggestion.
But we couldn't think of a whole lot more than that. I mean, there isn't the equivalent, and perhaps it's because not so many films that are only about women get made. In fact, yeah. I would submit that's probably the reason.
Yeah.
And yet you can think of opposite sex duos that aren't necessarily, even though they always end in romance. Tracy and Hepburn.
Yes.
Is I would argue fit into the same sort of format. There's an underlying weird chemistry, mm-hmm. which is allowed to become sexual or at least romantic.
Yeah.
But a lot of those movies that they made together are sort of buddy madcap comedies.
Yeah, and it works because in the most of those cases, the screenwriters would take their personalities as their personas as actors and maybe as human beings and play that up in the roles so that we could watch them be different, so that, you know, Tracy would be the sort of down-to-earth, meat-and-potatoes kind of guy, and somehow Hepburn would be slightly fancier or mm-hmm. This play out her kind of Connecticut Yankee character that she did in so many movies. And that's what audiences liked, is they liked seeing that kind of stuff brush up against each other.
Isn't the sports department downstairs?
Yes, I guess it is, but I...
Then aren't you going in the wrong direction?
Maybe I am. Are you always much too busy?
What for?
I was wondering about this afternoon.
Sorry.
Tomorrow afternoon?
What's on your mind?
I'd like to take you to a baseball game.
Okay.
Obviously, you would think of Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers as being another pairing of a similar... They made a similar number of movies as Tracy and Hepburn.
With the same kind of... Well, I call it witty repartee. It's mm-hmm. not always witty. Sometimes the scripts are poor, but it seems that these movies are, with some exceptions, but not a lot of exceptions, are about not only the characters that these two actors play, but the interchange that they have with one another.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's physical, but
right.
often it is a dialogue that's ongoing.
I think, you know, you think about, obviously, of course, Astaire and Rogers are making it physical by the way they dance together, and so that makes them sort of exceptional in this realm. But yeah, I agree that knowing that sort of conversational rhythm, the patter that goes on between them, that is key. And that's a really interesting thing. And you see it, I mean, you see it in your daily life too, with
sure.
people that you know. And there are some people who you're just always stepping on each other's lines and it doesn't work. And then there are other people that somehow the radar is out and you just know how to fill in that little gap. And when you watch some of these teams, that's a lot of the satisfaction, is that somehow, like jazz musicians or mm-hmm. something, and we go back to Hope and Crosby for that, because, of course, Crosby was literally a jazz musician and Hope was out of vaudeville. Somehow they had the beats down so that it didn't seem like they were stepping on each other's lines, and they would fill in. If you watch those movies, they fill in what was probably the written dialogue with these little muttered asides that sometimes are funny and sometimes are just silly. But it's almost musical. It really is, you know, and it's very pleasing somehow to witness that.
So we named the sort of Jonah Hill, Seth Rogen, James Franco duos. Who else is doing that nowadays and successfully? Because we're in the era of this sort of global marketing of action films, which don't necessarily feature dialogue, although I suppose Robert Downey Jr. and the Iron Man, those movies do have...
They have that,
well,
yeah.
Because they have hit that persona that... is either really him or the one that he affects, that sort of world-weary wisecracker.
It's funny because in some ways those, let's say the, not only Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson, but Owen Wilson made a couple of films with Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan made a couple of three films with Chris Tucker, who is very verbally adept. But more and more you see a lot of, not so many where it's two big stars paired, but where it's a big star and then he'll have a comic sidekick who kind of fills that in you know, the Tom Arnolds of the world or someone like that, or Jonah Hill or whoever it is.
But there's also the interesting pairing to me in the three Ocean's 11, whatever, I think they're all named Ocean's 11, the George Clooney-Brad Pitt pairing.
Mr. Ocean, what do you do for a living? You don't mind me asking?
Why would I mind you asking? Two cards. I just got out of prison.
Really?
Well, why were you in prison? I stole things.
You stole things?
Like, jewels?
Ink and matrimonial head masks.
Any money in those? Ink and matrimonial
head masks, there's some.
Don't let them fool you. There's boatloads. If you can move them, take one. But you can't.
My fence seemed confident enough.
If you're dealing in cash, you don't need a fence.
People lack vision.
Probably everybody in cell block E.
That's $500.
They're funny and they're tongue-in-cheek, and they are also doing that riff with one another. Mm-hmm. It is that ba-boom, ba-boom.
Yeah, at their best, those movies get into that realm. You keep thinking that George Clooney is one of those guys who would get into this because he does seem like a bit of a throwback to the 40s or something. I mean, he's got that aura around him, and he seems to have a funny streak.
So do we like them as audiences because, I mean, we like big thriller things and creepy movies because they scare us, but do we like these because they feel comfortable or because that could be me on screen?
I think both, yeah. I think there's something really fun about seeing people who are simpatico, and you can tell, and it could be people who are dancing, but in you know, most cases it's this idea that the people on screen perhaps really like each other, and that comes across in a way that maybe has nothing to do with the plot. Maybe it serves the plot, but it seems to be operating beyond that. And I think a lot of our pleasure for movies comes from things that are we're not going to worry about who done it. We're just going to worry about how they got there.
There is one movie, Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock, a movie called The Heat.
Okay, I look like I've been attacked.
That's not my fault.
Well, it's my fault?
Let me even out the bottom.
Okay, would you just stop carving up my clothes?
I'm making shorts. Everybody likes shorts. Jesus, hold still.
Oh, please, just... Well, hey. That feels awkward, weird. Just don't touch that area.
Well, don't duck down. You're going to suck my hand up there.
Stop pulling my pants off.
Jesus.
What?
What are those?
What are those?
Stop it.
They're my Spanx. They hold everything together.
Why? What's going to come popping out?
And we'll see if that will change this idea of the... are they going to call it the cismanse or what?
I don't know. We just made that
up. Okay.
But in talking and reading articles and in their conversations with the press... it very much was a friendship that developed between the two of them on set. So apparently they did have that same kind of chemistry that women don't maybe often get the chance to exhibit. Because a lot of movies about women together are they're sort of the leading lady with the nerdy friend, and the leading lady has romantic issues, and the nerdy friend watches and encourages her. That's usually the relationship.
Yeah. And it'll I think Hollywood is watching to see whether the success of Bridesmaids might be followed by the success of The Heat, and therefore you will see a movie where Tina Fey and Amy Poehler are actually in the same movie.
Baby Mama.
They
did make one together.
Yeah.
In addition to hosting the Golden Globes together.
Maybe a good movie. I'm convinced that one of the reasons that Seth Rogen, Jonah Hill, James Franco, Danny McBride, there's this whole group of people that one of the reasons those various movies are successful is that the audience kind of knows that those people hang out together. And so we go to the movies thinking, oh, that'll be fun because it'll be kind of a hangout movie and it'll be kind of this natural rhythm. And maybe that will also occur with the future Tina Fey, Amy Poehler films or whoever might be in them.
Okay, so listeners, your task now as we... and our incredibly in-depth dissection of bromance and cismance is to propose some other pairs, particularly women that you'd like to see together where you think that chemistry might work. You can email them to us weekday@kuow.org or you can post them to our Facebook page, which is Weekday on KUOW. Robert Horton writes about film for the Everett Herald. He has a website blog called Crop Duster where you can find him. He's monthly at the Fry Art Museum hosting the Magic Lantern film series and Wednesdays here on KUOW. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marcy.
-72 degrees in Seattle and mostly sunny. Forecast says expect sun all day with an afternoon high of 84. Tomorrow, Thursday, some morning clouds, then sunny again by afternoon with a high of 82.
Scott Simon of NPR News here. Together, KUOW and NPR bring you stories that you just won't hear elsewhere. Stories that go beyond the headlines and keep you inspired and informed. Your financial support makes all of this possible. So if it's been a while since you've made a gift to KUOW, please renew your support today. It's easy. Go online to KUOW.org. Thank you.
It's 10:42.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Microsoft released its quarterly earnings report last week, and let's just say it really wasn't very pretty. The company took a $900 million hit, and that was largely based on the poor performance of the Surface tablet. GeekWire co-founder, national editor Todd Bishop is back with his Surface tablet.
That's right.
Right next to you. You actually bought one, but before we talk about what you like and don't like about the thing, why were things so bad last week for Microsoft?
So Microsoft released the Surface RT tablet, as they called it, to be a direct competitor with the iPad last fall. And what they found was it did not sell in nearly the volumes that they had hoped. And so just recently they cut the price from, right around $500 to $350. And because of that, they're having to take this gigantic charge, $900 million, which is just $100 million short of $1 billion by my calculations.
Yep.
And it's just, it really has not found its niche yet. It's going up against a very formidable competitor in the form of the iPad. And I think because of that, it's going to take Microsoft a couple more tries at this to really gain any traction, if it will at all.
Now, you wrote about this on GeekWire. You had money. You convinced your wife to take the $500-some and put it in a Surface tablet instead of an iPad because, I assume, for research purposes.
For research, it's been great material. It's basically fueled the...
life with the Surface.
Exactly. I was counting this morning. I've written about 10 Surface diary posts just about... experiencing this device. And really, I wouldn't do this with just any device. This is Microsoft's first computer, mm-hmm. essentially, if you can count a tablet as a computer. And so it's something that you really need to experience firsthand if you're going to cover it. So I've been doing it, highs and lows.
It's a little more oblong than an iPad.
It is.
But it's about the size of an iPad, more or less.
Roughly. The big difference, and I'm holding it vertically now in the portrait mode, it's ridiculous to use in portrait mode. It is much more appropriate to use in landscape mode, and that's really the way it was designed. Okay. And it's actually one of my main criticisms of it is, it's so vertical when you hold it in portrait mode that it's almost unfeasible to use.
It is also not light.
Right. Well, and now I happen to be holding a Surface Pro,
which is the big heavy duty one.
Right. And Surface Pro runs full Windows 8. You can run your old legacy Windows applications on there, Photoshop and everything else.
Do you have the RT at home as well?
The RT at home is the one that I do have. Yes.
And so how does the weight compare with this big Pro?
I actually don't have the specs in front of me, but
it's lighter.
It's noticeably heavier. Yeah.
So as far as, you're not in the mind of every consumer who opted for one device over another, but what have been the main reasons that somebody might balk at buying one of these Surfaces?
Initially, the price was relatively high when you were comparing it to comparable devices, such as, for example, the Kindle Fire. Amazon has really mm-hmm. led the market in terms of driving down the prices of tablets. Also, just some of the negative publicity, and I perhaps was responsible for some of this, around Windows 8 on the desktop computer. Windows 8 on traditional PCs can be a bit of a struggle to learn at first. And I think perhaps some of that negative halo effect had some impact on sales on the tablet, even though the tablet version of the operating system is great. I would actually say that Windows RT on the Surface is far more intuitive to somebody just coming to it fresh than iOS on the iPad. So
you also write about the look of the thing.
Yeah.
It's black.
It's black. It's the edges are sharp. And just in our family and our usage, it doesn't quite fit with a comfy living room in the same way that the iPad does. And I realize that's aesthetic, but that is important. Devices are not only about what you can do with them, but about how they make you feel as you're doing those things. And those are the kind of first world problems that we all get to enjoy.
That's what you write about, Todd, exactly. At GeekWire. What do you guys at home use your Surface for?
Primarily Netflix streaming, some YouTube. My daughter likes to play Fresh Paint, which is an application where you can basically mimic oil painting. She's a toddler, so she loves to get in and paint things.
She's playing.
Exactly. She likes to play with it. The Surface RT and the Surface Pro were both also meant to act as pseudo notebooks. We don't end up using the Surface RT in that way. It comes with an attachable keyboard accessory that you actually buy separately, and we haven't ended up using that.
Hmm. Well, so we're talking about the device itself for this organization that's just repositioned itself to be all about devices.
That's
and
right.
Services, devices and services. But in terms of earnings, not only did they take this $900 million hit, almost $1 billion hit, but they fell below what was anticipated for investors. And that's kind of riled up folks who are sort of circling like sharks around the company.
That's right. There's an investment firm called ValueAct that is amassing shares in Microsoft and making a push for a board seat. Mm. This is really the first crack in the armor that we've seen in terms of the Microsoft board. Even over the past decade, as the stock has been stagnant, for the most part, the board has been solid. And now we do see this company or this investment firm coming in and apparently making some headway in getting onto the board.
What would it mean if this company actually got a seat? What does it mean for Microsoft?
This company would be able to enact change that perhaps the board on its own might not be able to do. For example, Microsoft has a ton of cash, billions upon billions of dollars. I think it's more than $70 billion in short-term investments in cash and cash equivalents as of the last measure. So part of their hope is to give that back to shareholders in the form of additional dividends and other kinds of disbursements, buying back shares, things that the board can do to make up for the fact that the stock price in and of itself has not been all that lucrative for shareholders.
What is the stock price right now?
Something I'd have to look. It's been changing. It's hovering right around $30 a share. So it's been in that range for quite a while. Now, after earnings last week, it fell more than 11% in one day. So it's been a rough week.
Well, it's interesting because Apple issued its earnings report yesterday, I believe, and before that, or maybe today, before that report came out, it was trading at $429 a share or something that I had to look at several times because it's, eight times more than Microsoft is trading for.
No, you can't just look at the share price. You have to look at the actual market value because it all depends on the number of shares outstanding, and then you do that calculation to figure it out. I could do a quick look up here, but I know Apple's market value is higher than Microsoft's by quite a bit.
And so that earnings report showed one interesting thing, they're not, I don't believe that they fell much below what market expectations were. As I understand it, they were kind of flat, but that the iPhone itself hadn't totally fizzed out.
That's right. The iPhone sales are continuing to surprise people in terms of their strength, the ongoing ability. And it's interesting in part because you've got Android, which is a really strong competitor. Nokia had a strong quarter in terms of sales of its Windows mm-hmm. phones. It was more than 7 million units shipped. So the fact that Apple is still doing well with the iPhone in the face of that is very notable.
Well, I did hear Tim Cook, who I think is the CEO of Apple, on a conference call reported this morning, and They're looking to new markets for the phone, including India. I think that's the next place where they're expecting to sell a billion telephones. So even if it's all a first world problem, Apple isn't looking necessarily to the first world for sales.
That's right. And that is the traditional tech rollout process, as you start in the developed countries and then you eventually expand into more of the developing nations. And truly, you know, China, India, those are the big markets for a lot of these tech companies, with lots of different nuances there, especially in China, as they go forward and try to grow.
Well, it's all interesting. The Microsoft reorg is, what, 2 weeks, 3 weeks old at this point?
Yes.
So it's too soon to say whether Steve Ballmer's refocus is going to change things at the company. But one thing that a lot of folks in the video game universe are happy about in terms of Microsoft is a new, and you and are included in that, a new Halo game, Spartan Assault, has just come out, which you are playing on your Surface.
Yeah, we booted up my Surface and it was a little bit of a revealing moment there. My Halo game was going. I didn't remember that I had that going. Yes, this is a new installment in the Halo franchise. It's different in that it's not a first-person shooter. It is a third-person shooter, as they say. It's over the top. You look down on the scene versus being through the eyes of
over
one
the
of the
top.
Characters. It's basically you're looking down over the top of the scene. Versus,
from your drone.
Well, yes. You're still controlling one of the characters, but you're not looking through that person's eyes.
Okay, so this all sounds good, great on your Surface, but there was one little key missing here.
So this was released ostensibly for Windows Phone in addition to Windows 8 and Windows RT. The problem is Microsoft did some sort of exclusive deal with Verizon where only Verizon customers on Windows Phone get the game for the first month. And so here I am, you know, a loyal Windows Phone user. This was also along the lines of my Surface test. I've been writing about my Windows Phone experience. And, you know, this is the kind of thing where this is a rare reward for Windows Phone users to have a great exclusive game, and here we have to wait for it for another month if we're not on Verizon. It can rankle you a little bit.
Well, that goes back to one of the other issues with the Surface and the phone, and that has to do with apps. I mean, the world of app development has been focused on Apple products and maybe for Android at this point in time, right?
That's right.
But not Windows.
No, Microsoft is making some headway here. They've had some key wins over the past few months. And it's a situation where there are, I don't know, I guess I'd estimate maybe 40%, 50% of the apps that you'd really want are on the Windows Phone. But it's really different for every specific person. That's why a guess like that is really rough. The chances that your favorite app from iOS or Android are going to be on Windows Phone, it's not all that great. Instagram is a good example of
one. That's not on a Windows Phone?
No, it's not on Windows Phone. Now, there are other examples of apps out there that are coming and that are on Windows Phone, but there are still some big holes.
Well, we're talking with Todd Bishop of GeekWire. What about the City of Seattle's new parking app?
That's right. No, not for Windows Phone.
No.
Just iOS and Android. Although I did look into this. They have a web interface. So this is the new service that's rolling out in Seattle where you're actually going to be able to pay for your parking through your phone rather than through the stand-up kiosks on the street.
And so the idea is that there's a company that they've contracted with, and theoretically you download something to your phone, your Android or iPhone. And how does it work?
So you go in and you set the amount of time that you're going to be in a particular space. You designate the space that you're in. And then if you, for example, only parked or paid for 2 hours in a four-hour space, say you're in your meeting longer than you thought you were going to be, you can just sit there on your phone and say, hey, extend my time in this period, and you don't get nailed with a ticket.
I didn't realize that the spaces actually had labels.
They must. That was news to me as well, but they must.
Where are they?
Yeah.
Where do you find that information? That's
a really good question. I'll have to look into that.
Now, this parking is, at this point in time, it's a pilot area. This is not citywide, is it?
Not yet. No, they're piloting it in some selected areas of the city, and then it'll roll out, I believe, by the end of the year.
There is, in addition to how much you pay for the parking, I noticed that there is an additional fee to pay for parking on your phone through this app that you don't incur when you just stick your credit card in the machine.
Okay. That's actually news to me. I didn't
35
know.
35 cents. 35 okay. cents extra to park.
I like you reading the fine print there. That's good, Marcy.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, maybe for some people it doesn't make a difference, but we have, as I understand, some of the highest parking rates in the country. So adding another 35 cents.
That is true. That's something that has to be taken into consideration, although I'll take that over the $44
yes.
ticket. And the other catch here is that you cannot extend the time beyond the upper limit. So in other words, if it's a 4-hour space, if you park there originally for 4 hours,
you've got to move your car.
You've got to move your car. You can't just go into your app and say, hey, give me another 4 hours.
No, it's interesting to me, and this is a more philosophical, briefly, question. 25 years ago in Europe, in France in particular, people were using home computers to do a lot of these transactions. It was before cell phones, and then things migrated over to phone. And it seems like other places are ahead of at least Seattle, but definitely more the United States when it comes to using your phone for daily transaction.
Yeah, you know, that is true. Mobile transactions, and I don't know if this is still the case, but for many years there, even just smartphone technology was much more advanced in Europe, especially in other parts, other countries overseas. So that is true, and especially Asia, something yeah. where we were playing catch up. I think you may have seen that change a little bit as the center of smartphone computing has shifted to Android and iOS, and you've got a lot of the powers of the global smartphone industry, you know, basically here on the West Coast.
And soon we'll have chips in our heads. Todd Bishop, co-founder and national editor of GeekWire, user of Windows Phone and Surface Tablet, a regular Wednesday guest here on Weekday. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Marcy.
Especially with all your toys. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Willett's our engineer. I'm Marcy Silman. Tomorrow, you may have heard about the city of Detroit contemplating selling off the holdings in the Detroit Institute of Arts. Well, what would it mean to lose an art collection? Not in the forecast for Seattle, but we're going to talk with the director of Seattle Art Museum about the inherent and financial value of a city's cultural holdings. That's tomorrow on the program. Hope you can join us.
And the program is KUOW's Weekday, which airs weekday mornings from 9 to 11. /10:59 Goat milk lovers, take note. There's a recall of one type because of possible E. coli contamination. KUOW's Lisa Brooks has that in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
This doctor treated nursing home patients.
The medicines I was prescribing were not treating the true source of suffering, which was loneliness.
Then a radical idea.
Let's abolish the nursing home.
And replace it with greenhouse homes. The Greenhouse Project, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Program begins this afternoon at 2 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from University Bookstore. Portland tattoo artist Levi Greenacres will discuss his new book, Mommy's New Tattoo, A Bedtime Story for People, from Schiffer. Friday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at U Bookstore on the Ave. More information at ubookstore.com.
Join KUOW for Green Stage's 25th year of Shakespeare in the Park.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.